I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Dr. Sad is a novel about a middle-aged teacher and poet. He is gay and has recently been diagnosed with HIV. Its author is David Bateman, and he joins me now to discuss it and the character and the time of life he finds himself in. He's getting older, and his view on mortality might alter life as he knows it. Stephen crosses the country from here in Vancouver through to smaller cities along the way, like Kamloops, through to Toronto. We see what campus life is like, what small towns are like, not just physically but mentally. The reader is offered a view onto the streets of Kamloops, as well as Toronto's gay village. The book is semi-autobiographical, and we'll discuss David's time here in Vancouver as well. David Bateman is a freelance journalist, painter, and performance poet. He has published numerous books of poetry and has taught literature and creative writing at various post-secondary institutions across Canada. He joined me from Toronto, Ontario. Dr. Sad is published by University of Calgary Press as part of their Brave and Brilliant series. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, David Bateman. Dr. Bateman, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Good to hear from you.
And nice to talk to you as well. When we meet Stephen in the beginning of the book, where is he in his life?
Well, he's in his early 40s, I suppose, and middle age, sort of mid-middle age. I think of middle age as 30 to 60, which a lot of people think that's too early. But
yeah.
So he's in the middle range of middle age.
And what is he like, if you had to describe what his personality is like?
Well, it is semi-autobiographical, but I bring that up first because, I mean, that's a very loose term. I'm basing it on experiences, but much of it is fictional, so it's a kind of unusual hybrid, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
He's got the kind of personality that, in the face of a lot of really difficult life moments for himself and the people surrounding him, He struggles to have a very positive outlook, but it's a constant sort of, how do I do this? It doesn't come, for lack of a better word, it doesn't come naturally. He kind of struggles against different kinds of, I suppose, melancholy. I think melancholy is something that I do describe in the novel a little.
Uh-huh.
And my sense of melancholy, my earliest association with melancholy is through, of all things, Freud, when I was studying a bit of Freud through queer theory, and he has very specific ideas of melancholy and very specific ways of working through it as a kind of psychoanalytic term. So I think the character of Stephen struggles with that, with those notions in a fairly successful way.
Life doesn't come easy, you, as you just said, and I guess for a lot of people, Stephen especially, he's the sort of person who'd wish that life came with sort of a manual or an idea of how to get through it, if you will.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he works like myself, but again, it's very different in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
He's an artist and an academic. So in some parts of his life are very ordered, and when you're working as an academic, which is what I have done, I still do to a degree, but
sure.
What Stephen is doing in the novel, there has to be a certain amount of order around structural things like grading, like weekly classes, and that's partly what informs the structure of the novel, a day-to-day, class-to-class kind of structure. And then there are what I guess I could call flights of fancy when he takes a break those on his own. For example, the lengthy period in the book where he takes a road trip from Kamloops to Banff.
Uh-huh.
The book opens in one of the early chapters on the Coquihalla from Vancouver to. So there's intervening moments between that basic structural element, which is day to day class. I think, like when you're teaching in an academic setting, you know, maybe have two or three classes a week, depending on. And that's where the novel pretty much begins after the prologue, where the class in the university in Kamloops.
What does your book say about the difference between, say, big cities in this country, and say some of the smaller, more remote ones? Because it's fascinating as we read the book, and I've only read a little bit of it, but I see where he's going and the places along the way, And there's a real difference, isn't there, between the sort of cities that we see in this country.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I've lived in various cities in the country, and I've spent most of my adult years, and I like the character in the book, in Toronto, the largest city in Canada, of course, but of course, unlike the U.S., there's many large cities.
Uh-huh.
So we don't have, as far as our geography goes, as wide a variety to compare a large city experience to. People think of it in Toronto, where I live and where the character lives, although, again, it's that curious blend of autobiography and complete fiction, is probably one of the busiest intersections in the largest city in Canada, right overlooking Dundas Square. So it's just radically different. People, when I was teaching in Kamloops and when I've taught in other places, even as close as Oshawa, which is a small suburban area of Toronto by train, when I was teaching there, younger students would just sort of marvel at how can you live in such chaos? How can you? And I don't really see it that way. It's a kind of ordered chaos, and I've spent a long period of almost half my life in that. So then going somewhere like Kamloops, which is fairly close to Vancouver, which is considered a relatively large Canadian city, but I've lived in Vancouver, and it is a large Canadian city, but compared to Toronto, I loved Vancouver, but compared to Toronto, it's much, much smaller.
Yeah.
So it's I think the contrasts are very sharp. The smaller town, and then, like, when I'm talking about the smaller town in the book, I'm talking about Kamloops, which is very different than... It's kind of a paradox. It's very different from my hometown in southern Ontario, Peterborough, uh-huh. but at the same time, there were things about Kamloops when I lived there that reminded me a lot of Peterborough. So there are similarities. So there are huge contrasts, and there's not as much to compare to, obviously, in a country this size that went with a smaller population density. And then the smaller towns, of course, Peterborough and Kamloops are considered small cities when, of course, there's lots of places much, much smaller throughout the country. And I don't have as much experience in that, but I think, you know, it's by contrast and population density that I think that's certainly what characterizes my experience in Canada when living in larger cities and smaller cities.
And it's not just an issue of size or the physical size of it, but it's the mindset as well, isn't it? And in a marvelous way that you draw us into the ideas that we have around sex, especially the experiences that Stephen has, right?
Yes, of course. And although my experience, of course, I'm in my mid-60s, and my experience, unlike the experience of the character, he's younger. He's quite a bit younger in the novel, and I experienced very small town kinds of phobias around queer identity in the 1950s and 60s. So he doesn't talk about that so much. He talks about it a little as part of the character, but the phobias that he encounters in places like in smaller cities are coupled with a kind of freedom you get when you're living in a small town that also has an academic community. So there's another contrast. The academic community can be, and the students can be, a very different kind of mindset than the actual community. And I'm not putting a value judgment on either. I'm just saying they can be very different. Yeah. And when you say around sex, certain sexuality, yeah, the stereotype is that in smaller towns, we tend not to see the same kind of liberationist models flourishing as much, but they do now more than they did when I was in my teens in a small town in southern Ontario. And Stephen's, in the novel, Stephen's journey, there's very sexual elements, but they're not directly related to that, the community living. They're kind of flight of fancy that occur outside of that. He gets involved with someone in Banff didn't realize that he knew him earlier in a very fleeting moment in Kamloops. So those escapades, which is what they are, they kind of happen separate from it. And none of the sexuality, and the sexuality of a couple of students comes into it. But it's just more of a sub-narrative. It's the main narrative, Stephen's journey, and the students kind of radiate around that because it's, um, because they're also part of the poetry narrative, their own poetry, Stephen's poetry.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of what it's like to try to teach poetry as a part of, as a part kind of language. You know, how do we turn our, what we're feeling or what we're trying to describe into poetry through a different kind of language. And that's what that's primarily what he's teaching in the context of the novel.
When would you write the poetry that we read in the book? Would that be as you were writing, say, the fiction part of it, or would you have written the poems beforehand?
No, mostly like it's both. Some of them, I think it's in the book. I mean, it's just part of the footnotes. But some of them are from my collections. I have four collections of poetry from Frontenac House Press in Calgary when I studied in Calgary in the early 2000s, and some of the poems are directly from there, and they're examples of Stephen's poetry. I use my poetry, so that's where you get a kind of unusual blend of myself and the semi-fictional character. All of the student poetry was written as I wrote the novel, as it came up. If there's a classroom setting and they're given an exercise, for example, they're given an exercise around haiku,
and so
all of that was written within that context, and it related to some of the other themes. And that was my experience when I was teaching in Kamloops. It's very loosely based on some of the ways I taught poetry when I was teaching there and when I've taught elsewhere.
What is it a different mindset that one has to go into, say, if they're writing a novel versus writing poetry? I mean, did you find that the physical setting where you might write might not be different, but did you find that your mind works differently, say?
Well, it's certainly for me, because this is my first longer, you know, piece of writing. It's my first novel. I've written longer pieces, but it's the first novel-length prose. And I found over the years writing poetry, it's not without, the way I write poetry, it's not without structure, but it has less, the kinds of poetry I write has less structure as far as the day-to-day writing of it than I would say, and when I say the day-to-day writing, the actual work I'm doing from 1 hour to the next, that it has less structure than the novel. The novel, as far as the workday goes, was very structured, like I did typical things, like, and it's over, it's almost 10 years ago that I worked for a year on it on an art council funding in Ontario, and so I had charts. I had charts of all the chapters, the timeline, the dates. So that's a very basic difference for me when I wrote a novel. So it's a much more ordered. So I know what's going to happen later on. In a poem, I tend to be more free. Although I've written haikus. I've written various very ordered structured poems, but for the most part, my poetry is more of a kind of open verse which is somewhat lyrical tradition. But I don't plot it out in the way I plot out. There are exceptions, of course, in some of my longer poems, but none of those are in this book. I would say the novel is much more structured, and it's much like I would sit down every day and write for a certain amount of time. And that structure changed over the year, but it was a pretty focused structure that way. So I would sit and I'd say, okay, this is the chapter I'm at, and so I wrote it in that way. And I didn't have a completely ordered structure. I didn't know exactly where it was going to end, but that came to me as I was doing it.
You mentioned a moment ago the book being a blend, say, of fiction and episodes of, say, autobiography. When you decide to write a book that way, so a reader might say, "Well, why don't you pick one instead of the other?" But I guess the novel is so much richer when it comes from a writer who adds, say, experiences that one has had, and the autobiographical parts perhaps are more. Clearer is not the right word, but you know they're clarified, if you will, through the lens of fiction, I suppose, because you've had time to think about it from a different angle.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always make a bit of a joke about my writing, as I set out to write something completely fictional, and within 100 words, I'm telling another story about my life. I can't seem to avoid it.
Yeah.
I think I say something like that. I think there's a kind of thing, a little short blurb at the end that I wrote about that. I've forgotten exactly what it. I look for it, but I actually don't have a copy of it yet. So, I'd be looking at some of that. But my life and my experiences, because my work before, and also I'm also a performance poet and write performance monologues. I don't do it as much as I used to, but that was basically what I always did in my 30s and 40s before I began to do more studying in Calgary and in various places teaching. But they were completely autobiographical performance monologues. They ranged from 5 to 15 minutes to an hour and a half, and I toured them around various cities in Canada, the U.S. a little, and abroad a little. I had that. That was always a part of my impulse from my early 20s. Some of my influences are people like Spalding Gray and Karen Finley, and then in Canada, people like Daniel McIver and Shauna Dempsey and Laurie Milan, who often did stuff based on their lives. So by the time I got in my 40s and 50s writing a novel, that stuff was already so much a part of my process, and I was trying really hard to write fiction, and I couldn't for the life of me just do fiction. So it becomes this undeniable impulse in a way. I can't get away from it. And I mean, my feeling about a lot of novels, certainly not all. There's lots of pure fiction out there, whatever that means. But
yeah.
But a lot of stuff comes from people's experiences, even if they're completely different characters. We draw from our experiences in order to build those characters, in order to flesh them out and give them some kind of authenticity around their lives and the way they conduct themselves in various situations.
I suppose it makes it easier when one adds, say, episodes from their past. When a reviewer or an interviewer might ask the author, did that really happen? Well, the author can say, yeah, it did to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting you asked that, too, because part of the marketing that we did, that some of those questions were asked of me. And I just kind of jokingly said, well, there would probably never be any need, but it would be interesting for me someday to go through and annotate the whole thing and say, oh, which one is true?
Yeah.
Which parts are true? Because I don't always, you go through something and you don't always remember the exact truth is. You don't, and you look at it and you say, okay, that's like what happened in Banff, but it's not what happened in Banff. And one part of the narrative that I can confidently point to is that the experiences that Stephen has in Toronto in between chapters, they're completely fictional. They're set in a setting very close to where I live in Toronto, very close to what that setting is like, but the actual experiences and his romantic and sexual encounters are complete fiction. They're not really based on, I would say that's the closest thing to pure imagination and fiction in the novel.
Yeah.
So obviously they're going to be informed by my own experience with sexuality, but they're not based on any relationship that ever have been part of my life.
How does Stephen view mortality? Because a lot of us see life as, say, you know, just getting through it, just surviving, making it to the end of the day, if you will. Does Stephen see it that way? And does the diagnosis with HIV, does that, that would add, say, a logistical imperative to it all. But does it change how he views life?
Oh yeah, I think his character, like there is a longer 15-minute sort of performance poem that I wrote many years ago, and I make it Stephen's performance poem, and it's talking about discovering that you're HIV positive, and it's called What's It Like, and near the end he says, I actually have it right here, It says it's, and I think it describes him, it's a kind of, where's the quote, one of the quotes, it's a tentative, privileged state of living and dying with HIV. And certainly when I say that quote, what I mean is in the context of North American healthcare. It's tentative and it's privileged. We do have help, a lot of help moving through this pandemic, which, of course, we're in another pandemic now, but HIV has been considered a pandemic, an epidemic, many things over the many years that it's been part of a global problem. But then there's also the idea that it's even closer to how he feels about mortality. It's a kind of terror, but it's a very framed, privileged terror that he lives within. Not everyone lives within it. He's all, because the performance piece I talk about talks about being afraid, but it also talks about, and the time that Stephen becomes HIV positive, much like myself, I'm HIV positive, the time that he becomes is a much earlier period. Or a much later period, and there's far more help and security around it.
It's interesting to see the idea of thinking about how life will turn out or what life will be in the midst of a diagnosis like that, because I think it follows Stephen's concerns about, say, growing older and what that'll mean, right?
Right. Well, yeah, I suppose. But yes and no, because, like I said a moment ago, being diagnosed later in the pandemic,
it's changed,
radically different. You have a very, like now the statistics are, the last time I checked anyway, men with HIV have the same life expectancy as any other men,
right,
when they're on the drug.
Yeah.
That's when Stephen becomes HIV positive, when that is the case. But earlier on, the life expectancy was much, much shorter. It could happen very quickly. So it's a very particular part time in that epidemic. So he lives with uncertainty, but at the same time, he doesn't know, and I think that's part of his consciousness around mortality. He does, and it comes up in the novel. He doesn't really know, and neither do I. You know, like people, there are people living into their 80s and 90s now, and they've lived with HIV/AIDS for. I have friends who've lived with HIV/AIDS for over 25 years, and when you get into your 60s and 70s, there are so many other possibilities around mortality, right? And he lives with a kind of, like I said, a kind of privileged terror.
Yeah.
Marked by a lot of joy, a lot of work around being as happy as he can in that situation, so it's very uncertain. So he's always aware of mortality, but he's not. But it's very uncertain.
You mentioned earlier, David, about having lived in Vancouver previously. There is a poem, I believe. I think it's near the end of the book.
It's called My Vancouver.
Yeah, and so for people listening to us who haven't had a chance yet to pick up the book, could you give us a sense of how you yourself view Vancouver? Say,
I love living in Vancouver. I lived in Vancouver a relatively short time during a fall from September. I taught at Emily Carr.
Mm-hmm.
I lived there from. I was in a very privileged position. I lived in. Overlooking that small mountain at Fairview Slopes area that look over, and I taught. It was when Emily Carr was still on Granville Island, and I loved it. It was beautiful. I mean, being from Ontario, I found the weather was difficult for me. I just wasn't used to it. I was used to more sun and not rain. So, I mean, the weather's, given global warming, the weather's changed a lot now. But, I loved it. It's such a beautiful part of this country. There's so much to offer. I skied in those days. I don't ski anymore, so that was incredible to be able to skiing in Ontario is a profoundly different experience than it is skiing in BC. So there's so many things that were so different and so exciting about being there. And I lived there. That was the longest period I lived there. But I taught there a little at other times for shorter periods. But it's like you said, your question earlier about the cities, it's a much smaller city. So it takes, when you're used to Toronto, it's just, it's always, like I review theater. Well, I don't so much now, of course, because of COVID. But there's too much sometimes. You just have, if you can be going to four things a week. In Vancouver, it's smaller. So it takes a bit of getting used to. There's not as much, but that's just because of the size of the city. And there's so many other exciting and wonderful parts of it. But again, my experience there is very limited. I've been to Vancouver a handful of times and lived there very briefly.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I notice in the parts of the book that I have read, they're marvelous turns of phrases. They're often very funny lines in the book. Are you having fun as you're writing it, say?
Oh yeah. I mean that was my favorite part of it. I'd say, you know, the editing. I enjoyed the editing process. It went through two editors. Aretha Van Herk, and then Naomi Lewis did a later, more proofreading copy edit, and that was a wonderful and learning experience, because it's, like I said, my first longer piece, a novel. But the actual writing, because I was lucky enough to get a grant that paid me for a year, and I could just take that year and not worry about making money in other ways, and I just sat and I did it, and it had its moments of frustration, but it was in creating those experiences, some from memory, some pure fiction, for example, driving through the Rockies. And then, of course, there's a part that comes up more prominently near the end that I always noticed driving through the Coca-Cola area, I think in particular, the place names named after various Shakespearean characters, which can be fun to see that, but it can also be very conflicted because we know why that happened. It's a part of the theft of indigenous land and indigenous land rights, and that comes up throughout the novel. And as a person of white settler heritage, and settler is not really the best term these days, they're on the kind of periphery of your knowledge all your life. You're aware of it, and now in the last several years, we've been made more aware. Like, I came through a school system in the 50s and 60s that never mentioned it. So to my mind as a child, I didn't know how it was tied to the really conflicted and difficult way in which this country was settled and basically stolen from a whole other culture. So again, those are fun parts. The fun part to write and explore, but I think they reveal what I hope the novel reveals. They reveal how conflicted identity, whether it's national identity, whether it's sexual identity, it's underlying some of those identities. There's some really difficult, conflicted parts too. So I enjoyed the writing process. I enjoyed including those things, but I was also trying to be conscious of, as someone writing about a particular experience in Canada, the profound conflict that the strides are being made, trying to move forward, but there's so much more work to be done in the novel. It's not really the novel's intent to do. The novel's intent is to acknowledge that work and to be respectful of that work, but also to show how someone with a white working-class heritage, like Stephen, although his working-class heritage doesn't come up so much, how it moves through his life. I guess I kind of got quite far away from the original question around what I enjoyed about writing it, but as I said it, I realize, of course, some of the playful parts are also some of the most serious and difficult parts to try to manage.
They're also the important parts too of writing, right?
Yeah, they're important, and it's hard to know how well I've handled them. I don't know. That's up to the reader and any reviewers, I suppose, to let me know how I managed that.
As I told you at the outset, David, I haven't finished the book because there's just not enough time, really. And I'm not a very good reader of fiction because then I end up giving away stuff. But I am enjoying the book as I'm reading it. I appreciate your time today. Congratulations and good luck with it.
Well, thanks so much for having me on your program. It's great to talk to you about it.
Dr. Saad is published by the University of Calgary Press. It is part of their Brave and Brilliant series. Its author, David Bateman, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.